In this lesson, we will study one of the media types that is the core of most multimedia systems, audio. We will first understand the basic concepts underlying sound. We will also look at some facts about human perception of sound. And as most natural phenomena, sound occurs in an analog form, which has to be digitized in order to represent it and store it on a computer. We will look at this process of conversion with the help of a fundamental theorem in digital signal processing called Nyquist sampling theorem. Lastly, we will look at an alternative mechanism for representation of sound that has both good compression properties and provides ease of nonlinear editing. What we mean by that is we'll look at the concept of audio representation in the MIDI format, M-I-D-I, and this format has the advantage of being a lot more compressed than traditional representation, and also it allows you to disable or enable selective pieces of the audio being recorded. The crux of this material is derived from my own research notes and from Dr. Xinyan Li's course material at Simon Fraser University. Let's try to take a look at some facts about sound. Sound is a continuous wave that travels through air. The wave itself is comprised of pressure differences. Most often we represent sound as a sinusoidal wave. However, what we're going to do is first take a look at what we mean by these pressure differences. That is, the wave is made up of fluctuations in pressure, and these are often represented as analog voltage changes. The thing is, when we want to perceive sound or when we want to detect sound, as in the case of a microphone that records or detects sound, the detection of sound is accomplished by measuring these pressure levels and their succession in time. That is, as the pressure fluctuates, we record these changes in pressure as minute voltages, changes in voltage, and record that as the signal, which is the sound. It so happens that the human ear does this naturally as opposed to doing it with a microphone where we record them as analog inputs. The human ear does this by detecting the pressure differences when the wave impinges on your ear drum. You can see a image in front of you that shows how as the human ear is subjected to these pressure wave differences in pressure, it reacts by changing its shape, and as a matter of fact, it's more complicated than that, where these changes in pressure are conveyed into a liquid, which is then conveyed as electric signals to the brain, impulses to the brain, which detect it as sound. Sound, just like any other wave, reflects properties or has properties like reflection, refraction, and diffraction. We'll take a closer look at what some of these characteristics that waves exhibit, and sound being a wave also exhibits these characteristics. Like all waves, sound can be characterized by the properties frequency and amplitude. In order to understand these characteristics, let's take a look at one frequency component of sound. As we will do often in this lesson, we will isolate a particular component of sound. That is, sound as we perceive it can be represented as a combination, as a mathematical combination of sine waves or sinusoidal waves. These waves are sine waves at different frequencies and different amplitudes. This is normally done when we try to represent a sound digit as a signal, as an analog signal, by representing it as a series of sinusoidal waves, and that's traditionally what we call as a Fourier series representation of a digital signal. The frequency refers to the rate at which the wave repeats. It is expressed in terms of cycles per second or by the units hertz. The human ear, for example, is capable of perceiving wave frequencies in the range 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. It so happens that in the electromagnetic spectrum, this frequency range is almost all audio, and that's what we as human beings can perceive. Amplitude, on the other hand, is a measure of the displacement of the wave from the mean. In this case, the mean of the sinusoidal wave that you see in front of you is zero, and the displacement from zero in the positive or negative direction represents the amplitude. What I've shown here is the maximum displacement, and I'm calling that to be the amplitude. As you see in the figure, we've also represented what one cycle or one period is. An important thing to also notice is the amplitude is being a measure of the displacement from the mean. From a human perception point of view, this is related very closely to the concept of loudness, though there is more to loudness than just the amplitude. As I noted before, sound is a continuous wave, and as all natural phenomena, it is analog in nature. Microphones detect this analog input, which is nothing but a continuous sequence or series of voltages that are registered as the output of a microwave. However, in order to store this input in a computer, one has to convert it to a digital form. That is, we have to convert it into zeros and ones. Further, the continuous wave has infinite resolution. What we mean by that is, if you were to try to take the wave's values or the amplitudes at each and every point in the timeline, we will find that there are infinitely many points that one can take, and this makes it impossible to represent without discretizing it or digitizing it. So the question again is, why digitize? As I said, because we want to represent it in a computer, and a computer can only store numbers, and therefore one has to convert an analog signal, which is continuous in nature, into a discrete signal, which can be represented by a stream of numbers. In front of you, you see an example of sound as an analog signal. As you notice, this signal is not entirely sinusoidal in nature. That is, it's not a sine wave in the true sense that we normally represent a sine wave, because most often a sine wave has a definite frequency and a definite maximum amplitude. Whereas the wave you see in front of you can be easily represented by a sequence of sinusoidal waves. That is, a combination of sinusoidal waves can be used to represent the seemingly random fluctuation in the signal. Let's take a further look at the digitization process. As we said, digitization is achieved by recording or sampling the continuous sound wave at discrete points. The more frequently one samples, the closer one gets to capturing the continuity of the wave. To see what we mean by that, if you recall the figure that we just saw of an analog signal, if one were to represent or capture this signal in a computer as zeros and ones, the more frequently we sample it, that is, the more points on the line that we can capture, the more close we get to representing the wave in a faithful manner. So the first characteristic that we're interested in is the sampling. So sampling is the process of dividing the horizontal time axis into discrete points. That is, we are taking the timeline and saying that, well, this is a continuous timeline, but we will take discrete points on this timeline and say we're going to record the sample at one point and then the sample at the next point and so on. The other aspect of digitization is the measurement of the voltages at these discrete sampling points. As it turns out, These values may be arbitrary precision. That is, we could have values containing small fractions or decimal numbers that take more bits to represent. What we mean by this is, if you take at any particular point in this continuous analog signal and we try to measure what the voltage is, we could probably get a voltage of something like 2.357856, and there's no limit to it. In fact, it's probably more than, there are probably more decimal digits than that, but we have to limit the arbitrary precision and take it to a definite precision. So in order to cope with this arbitrary precision, we use a mechanism of quantization. What quantization does is, instead of using a scale that is of infinite precision, we use a scale that is of a finite precision, whereby we divide the vertical axis into discrete points of voltages or signal strength. For example, if I were to use an 8-bit quantization, that would divide the axis into 256 discrete voltage levels. Now, these 256 levels could be positive and negative together. So that's the total number of discrete voltages you could represent if you had 8 bits of quantization. While we're on the topic of quantization, it is important to note that not all quantization is uniform in nature or linear in nature. What we mean by that is, it's not always the case that we would divide the vertical axis into discrete points that are equidistant, that is, the interval between these points is a constant. As it turns out, the most popular approach to dividing the vertical axis happens to be a non-linear quantization, in which the scale is divided by using a logarithmic scale. That is, a vertical axis is a logarithmic scale. To understand why a logarithmic scale is preferred, the idea is that when one uses a nonlinear scale like a logarithmic scale, the smaller numbers, that is, the smaller signals, are given more importance than the larger amplitudes or larger signal strengths. As it turns out, most audio will have a majority of the signals will be of low amplitude value or low signal strength, and therefore there'll be more points in the lower part of the vertical axis and there'll be fewer points in the higher part of the vertical axis. Therefore, we could represent small numbers more precisely and not use the same level of precision for large numbers, which tend to represent large amplitudes or large voltages which are not of that significance. As it turns out, this approach of nonlinear quantization is used in the mu law coding, which, by the way, is used in the Sun Audio format, which is the .au format. A similar but slightly improved version of the mu law coding is called A-law coding, which is used extensively in Europe. As it turns out, the nonlinear scale has several advantages. One which we already talked about, which is that it represents small amplitudes. It favors small amplitudes as opposed to large amplitudes, which tend to be fewer and less important in audio. And the other thing is that it tends to it exhibits this property of ignoring or not giving importance to noise, which can be easily ignored. As a matter of fact, the use of logarithmic scale is sometimes referred to as being very close to the way humans perceive sound. Let's take a demonstration of the concepts of sampling and quantization. Ahead of you, you see two graphs. The graph on your left demonstrates what sampling is. Again, we consider a sinusoidal wave and sample it at discrete points. We notice that the resulting sample values could be of arbitrary precision. So, in order to avoid this. That is, if it were of an arbitrary precision, then as I said before, you would have small fractions to represent, and so you would have to use a lot of bits. So we use a discrete precision or finite precision, and therefore we use 3-bit quantization to discretize these values to finite values. That's the figure on your right. There are a couple of important observations to make here. The first one is that process of quantization gives us finite precision values which are needed for representation on a computer. That is, once we get finite precision, we can represent it as zeros and ones without having to worry about describing large numbers. The second and more important question that one observation one makes is, how often should one sample the signal? That is, how frequently should you sample so that we make a faithful representation of the analog signal? As it turns out, this question will be answered by the Nyquist sampling theorem, which we will look at momentarily. A couple of other things to note. CD standard audio uses a sampling rate of 44,100 hertz, or 44,100 samples per second, which simply means that when you look at the samples that are recorded or that are present on your CD audio. By the way, your CD contains just a sequence of zeros and ones which represent the various samples taken at various sampling points of the recorded audio. As it turns out, in order to get the high quality that CD audio gives you, one has to take 44,100 samples for every second. Also, the CD standard audio uses a 16-bit quantization, which means that at every sample we take a value which is of precision of 16 bits, meaning that we can represent 65,536 values of signal strength. So now, once again, what the question is, why quantize? Well, we quantize so that we can get from the arbitrary precision to a finite precision, and we can only represent finite precision in a computer, and therefore we have to we quantize so that we can digitize and represent it on a computer. Let's take a look at the idea or the basic motivation behind the Nyquist theorem. As we just asked ourselves the question, how often should one sample analog signal in order to make a faithful representation of the signal digitally? So let's take an example. Let's consider a sinusoidal sound wave. If we were to sample it once every cycle, as you see in the first figure, it would appear as a constant signal. That is, I would take a sample every X number of seconds, and what you will see is that you would take a sample and then you would take another sample, and the X here is nothing but the cycle time. So we're taking one sample every cycle, and as it turns out, if you were to represent this in a computer and you would play it, it would come out sounding like just a constant signal value, and the constant value is probably some point on the sinusoidal wave. Now, let's try to increase the sampling rate. That is, let's sample it so that we take a sample twice every three cycles, or 1.5 times each cycle. Then it would appear as though we have a low frequency sine wave. Well, I say low frequency sine wave because you can do some extrapolation. That is, strictly speaking, what we really would have is a wave that has the shape of a sawtooth. That is, you'd have a sharp edge, and then you'd have a flat base, and then you have a sharp edge and a flat base, and so on. If we knew that it was a sinusoidal wave, then we can extrapolate and fit it to seem like a low frequency sine wave. I say low frequency sine wave because, as you see, the extrapolated wave seems to repeat less frequently than the wave that we are actually trying to represent. So therefore, it's a low frequency representation, or it appears as a low frequency signal. Well, now what Nyquist theorem suggests is that in order to get lossless digitization, that is, in order to make a faithful digital representation of the analog signal, one has to sample at twice the rate of the maximum frequency component. Well, in this particular example, there's only one frequency component because we're just looking at one single component of the sound. So what this is saying is we would have to sample this signal at twice the frequency at which this particular signal is fluctuating. Okay, thus in this example, one would have to sample the wave two times each cycle, and this might not seem very evident, but if you try to take this sinusoidal wave and try to take two points in each cycle, take any two points in each cycle, and you can always find that you can extrapolate it with a sine wave without any loss in information. I will show you other examples on the class website as the class proceeds. Let's take a look at some practical applications of the Nyquist theorem. By the way, Nyquist theorem is sometimes called the Nyquist sampling theorem also. There are some books that actually refer to as Shannon's sampling theorem also, because Shannon came up with a similar concept after Nyquist, but in a different context. Nyquist theorem is used to, as we said, calculate the optimum sampling rate in order to obtain a good audio quality. As a matter of fact, it's not just that we apply Nyquist theorem to audio, but it can be applied to any digital signal processing. Well, let's see some applications of it. Let's take a look at the CD standard sampling, which says that the sampling rate is 44,100 samples per second. Digitally sampled audio has a bandwidth of 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. That is nothing but the audio that we perceive as humans is in the range 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. By sampling at twice the maximum frequency, which is the maximum frequency being 20 kilohertz, if you were to sample at twice that rate, then we would get 40 kilohertz, and we would achieve a reasonably good quality. However, CD audio is going slightly above that. That is, instead of sampling at 40,000 samples per second, we are sampling at 44,100 samples per second. By increasing the sampling rate slightly, we're actually capturing a bandwidth that's around 22,050 hertz rather than just 20 kilohertz, which is what would have sufficed. Let's now take a look at the quality of a digital signal. We've been talking about sampling it, quantizing it, representing it, and now let's try to see how do you put a tag on the signal's representation and say, well, it's a high quality signal or a low quality signal. Well, we express this by a concept called the signal-to-noise ratio. A signal-to-noise ratio is given by the formula 10 log V square, the signal strength, square of the signal strength divided by the square of the noise. What do we mean by noise? Well, in any analog system, some of the voltage that you actually record is a measure of the entity, or in this case, sound that you want to record. Unfortunately, there's some noise, there are some unwanted fluctuations in the voltage which you do not want to record. However, one cannot entirely eliminate this. So what we try to do is, in order to represent the quality, or in order to understand the quality of a signal, we say that it is the ratio of the signal that is wanted divided by the signal that's unwanted. And that's taken That ratio is now, you take a log off that ratio and then multiply it by 10, and that's expressed as what we call as signal-to-noise ratio in units of decibels. As a demonstration of this concept, let's determine the quality of a signal which has noise introduced due to quantization. As a matter of fact, noise doesn't just happen as random noise that is that comes into existence because of some fluctuations in nature, but it can be introduced by the process itself. That is, the process of digitization can introduce noise into this signal. As we see, whenever we quantize, we are introducing as error. The quantization noise or error is nothing but the difference between the actual value of the analog signal at a sampling point and the nearest quantization value. What we mean by that is, at any point in time when we are capturing the signal strength, because we are quantizing it, we are saying that, well, if I have to represent it by arbitrary precision, I cannot represent it in a computer. So we say, let's approximate it to the nearest discrete point. If let's say the quantization value is between 4 and 5. I mean, those are the two quantization values. And let's say our number, the real observed voltage is 4.67. Well, we would probably approximate it to 5, and if it was 4.3 or 4.2, you would approximate it to 4. So in the process of approximation, we lose certain quality of the signal, and that is what we call as quantization noise. Obviously, in linear quantization, what I mean by linear quantization is that the scale of the vertical axis has points that are equidistant. That's linear quantization. In linear quantization, the worst case quantization error or noise is half the size of the interval. What we mean by that is, what is the worst possible error that you can introduce for a given sample? Well, if the observed value happens to be around, let's say, 0.5, let's say it's 0.51, and then we would approximate it to 1.0, which means that you introduced an error of 0.49. Well, in that sense, the worst possible error you can introduce is half the interval. Okay, so the largest quantization error is nothing but half the interval. Now let's try to understand what the maximum error introduced by the quantization can affect the signal quality. In other words, we would like to calculate the signal to quantization ratio in the worst case scenario. What we mean by the worst case scenario is, let's say we introduce the worst possible quantization noise, and at that particular point we have the maximum signal strength. So the worst case signal to quantization noise ratio will be given by taking into account the maximum signal and the maximum quantization error. Assume we are using n bits per sample. Using n bits per sample, the range of quantization values is going to be between minus 2 to the n minus 1 to 2 to the power of n minus 1. The worst case signal to quantization ratio, now we can calculate it to be 20 log V signal by V quantization noise. By the way, the 20 has come about by taking the squares out of the logarithm, and so previously it was 10 log V square signal divided by V noise square, and so we take the square out of the log, and so we get 20 log V signal divided by V noise. And here we are specifically looking at the noise that was introduced due to quantization, and so the denominator reads as V quantization noise. Which can be evaluated as 20 log 2 to the n minus 1, which is, by the way, we're looking at the maximum signal value, and the maximum quantization error, which is half, which is what we have in the denominator. By the way, half is 2 to the minus 1, and so we get 2 to the n minus 1 divided by 2 to the minus 1, which is just 2 to the n, which gives us n times 20 log to the base 2, which can be evaluated as 6.02 n. Again, the units of signal to noise ratio are decibels. What this calculation conveys is that every time we add a new bit, that is, let's say we're using n bits and we add another bit to the to our representation, whenever we add a bit, we get a 6 decibels or 6.02 decibels of resolution. What we mean by that is the quality of the signal has improved by 6 decibels every time we added a bit. So if we had 16 bits to represent our quantized value, then we would have a maximum signal to quantization noise ratio of 96 decibels. Before we wrap up the discussion of digital audio, it is interesting to note a few miscellaneous facts about digital audio. First, we find that the most popular audio formats are .au in Unix, which, by the way, uses Mulaw, and .aiff on the Mac, and .wave on the PC. Note that these are uncompressed formats. That is, there is no compression in these in the representation of .au or .aif or .wave. Formats like MP3 and Real Audio's RAM or RA involve compression, which will be covered later in the course. While we're talking about compression, I would like to draw your attention to a simple but popular method for compression called adaptive delta pulse code modulation, or ADPCM. In this method, the samples are predicted based on the behavior of past samples, and the difference between the predicted value and the actual observed value is coded. Just to get an idea of what we mean by this, imagine that the analog signal is fluctuating in a predictable way. That is, you have a sinusoidal wave. You would be easily able to ascertain where the wave is going in the next sample. You might not be precise, but you should be able to at least make an intelligent guess based on the behavior of the wave until that point and see, well, if it has been moving with a slope of 0.5, then you can extrapolate and say, well, the next sample is going to be at this particular point. Well, you might not be right, but you could come close to predicting it. Now, what we do is, at every point, we make a prediction, and we take the difference between the predicted value and the observed value, which typically is going to be a small number, and as we always repeat in the course, smaller numbers means fewer bits. So you would represent the sample not by the observed value that you would normally do, but you would represent the value at that particular sampling point as the difference, which is a small number. So when you are trying to decode it, all you would do is you would remember the previous value, add the difference, and then you would get back the value at this particular sampling point. And this simple idea tends to give a tremendous amount of compression in most audio formats. As a matter of fact, the Apple Macintosh and the people at Apple were one of the first to come up with this, with a very, very sound mechanism for doing adaptive pulse code modulation and get a significant amount of compression from their proprietary formats. Once again, to understand the source of compression, we should note that the smaller the number we represent, the fewer bits it takes. So instead of representing the actual value, we represent the difference between the value and the predicted number, and that tends to be small, and so we have fewer bits to represent it. Let's take a look at some audio quality data. That is, let's quickly go over some of the audio that we commonly come across, that is telephone audio representation, AM radio, FM radio, CD quality audio, and digital audio tapes. If you look at these various representations, we notice that the sampling rate varies significantly between each of these formats. Obviously, telephone quality audio, the main goal of telephone is not to play music or to transmit music, but what we really are trying to do is speech. That is, the goal of telephone is to encode speech that is uttered by one side of the of a phone and transmit it to the other side. So it turns out that speech, the maximum the sampling rate of 8 kilohertz is sufficient to represent it faithfully. And also, at each point, when the sampling is done, the number of bits per sample is 8. That determines what the quantization is. Further, telephone only does mono or single channel representation. Dual channels are what we call as stereo representation. And if you try to assess the data rate, we see that the data rate of telephone transmission is 8 kilobytes per second. That is, for every second of audio that is spoken audio in a telephone, if you were to represent it digitally, it would take up 8 kilobytes of space. To see why we got this 8 kilohertz, you would be able to look at, if you see what the frequency band of human audio or speech is, it turns out to be between 200 and 3400 hertz. So that's where, again, Nyquist comes into play. That is, the Nyquist theorem says that you should sample at the rate of twice the maximum frequency. The twice the maximum frequency here would have been 6800 hertz. Well, we've gone slightly above that, and we've done it at 8 kilohertz or 8,000 hertz. Similarly, AM radio has a sampling rate of 11.025 kilohertz. FM radio has 22 kilohertz, and notice that FM radio has dual channels or stereo, and also the bits per each sample is 16, and the data rate can be computed as 88 kilobytes per second. The interesting one to note here is the CD audio, which, as we talked about before, has 44,000 samples per second, at each sample being 16 bits long, and we have dual channels, that is stereo. And when you do the computation, this comes out to be 176 kilobytes for each second, and that's uncompressed, though, because most audio, early audio on CD, was uncompressed. What is interesting is to see that there are other ways of representing audio where this number of the data rate can be a significantly smaller. Lastly, digital audio tape is probably the highest quality audio representation that one can achieve, and the representation here is by a sampling rate of 48 kilohertz, which is 16 samples stereo and 192 kilobytes per second. Interestingly, this particular lecture that you're listening to is recorded on a digital audio tape before it's converted into one of the more popular formats to be deployed on your on the web. As I just referred to in the earlier part of the lesson, I said that there are some alternative formats for representing audio, one of which has emerged as a standard and which is used extensively in the music industry, is the music instrument digital interface, or MIDI protocol. It's a protocol that enables a computer and synthesizers, keyboards, and other musical devices to communicate with each other. as a side effect of this communication, what is also happening is to represent the audio generated by each of these devices. For example, when you have a when you have a keyboard synthesizer where human is playing the keyboard, we would have different keys being struck, probably some levers being changed, or some setting sliders being moved, and things like that. All these activities can be recorded. That is, the fact that such an action is performed can be recorded, and this sequence of actions can later be at some point be played out to simulate what would appear as though it were an exact representation of the original sequence of events. Just look at a typical setup of MIDI. In the figure, you notice that we have a synthesizer or keyboard, and each of these MIDI modules has an input port, an output port, and what we call as a through port. Some modules are not sophisticated enough to have an output port. They might just have an input port and a through port. So what you see in your picture is a MIDI interface sound card, which is on the computer, which we also call as a sequencer, which has just an in and out, and a synthesizer, a keyboard, which has an in, out, and a through. And we have two modules, module A and module B, which both have an input port and a through port. A typical setup will look like this. The MIDI port, MIDI out port of the synthesizer is connected to the MIDI in of the sequencer. What that accomplishes is when we're trying to record the performer on the keyboard is playing some notes, and the notes are output through the output port, and they are served as input to the MIDI card, which is on the computer, and this will enable us to record the actions that the performer of the keyboard is indulged in. Also, the MIDI out of the sequencer is connected to the MIDI in of the synthesizer, and though it doesn't show here, the in turn is connected to the through, and the through daisy chains or chains a bunch of modules together. So the idea of this particular path is when at a later time we would like to play back the audio, then what we would see is the computer would drive, or the sequencer would have already recorded a file, would play the file, and the way it would play the file is its output would be sent to the synthesizer on the keyboard, and the synthesizer would synthesize whatever sound is being sent to it in terms of the MIDI in MIDI format, and in turn it would also send it through to all the MIDI modules. One possible MIDI module could be a guitar or a trombone or some other instrument which has a MIDI module attached to it. So, in other words, what we have here is these instruments are being played without human intervention, because the computer is sending the relevant signals or MIDI messages to the various modules, including the synthesizer, to achieve or to mimic a particular note being struck or a particular string being pulled or something equivalent to that. As it turns out, the MIDI messages that are exchanged between the various modules have a very complex format. That is, they contain information that encapsulates the note that has been performed, probably the intensity with which the note was performed, that is the frequency and the frequency with which it was performed, and maybe even the volume or the intensity with which it was struck. So, in other words, the various MIDI messages typically have information about the note, its intensity, and in some cases, not a note is probably the to be played on a particular module. So the MIDI message will have a destination address also, which says that this particular note has to be played by maybe module A. Maybe there's a module, there's a note that has to be played by modules A, C, and probably D. And so the message will have within it information that says which modules are supposed to play the note. As I said, the data are grouped into MIDI messages. Each message communicates musical events. Musical events can range from pressing keys, moving slider controls, setting switches, and adjusting foot pedals. Just to give you an idea how much compression savings in data that MIDI representation gives us, we would see that 10 minutes of music encoded in MIDI data format is about 200 kilobytes of data. Contrast this with CD audio, where we said that 1 second of audio recorded on CD will take up 176 kilobytes of space. So 1 second is around 176, let's say that's around 200 kilobytes on a CD audio, whereas 10 minutes of audio recorded in MIDI format will take up the same amount of space. So that's a significant improvement. Well, obviously one might wonder if it is so good, why not use MIDI always? Well, there are several reasons for it. For instance, MIDI will not be able to represent human voice because obviously you cannot represent human voice by just a frequency and the intensity with which it was performed. For example, you can clearly say that on a keyboard, key number 35 was pressed simultaneously with key number 21, and this fact can be registered as a musical event, whereas a human voice cannot be precisely specified by in the form of a MIDI message. There are other problems too. The significant ones being that when we represent something in a MIDI format, eventually when it's played back, the way it sounds depends a lot on the kind of interpretation or the kind of synthesization that the particular computer does. So the same MIDI file can sound differently on different machines simply because the tables or the synthesizer tables that are used on each of these machines happen to differ significantly. It probably has to do with the amount of memory you have on the machine, the precision with which you represent the notes, maybe the particular software that is being used, maybe the particular manufacturer that has built the table. So the same MIDI file can sound very differently on two different machines, whereas the same audio recorded on a CD will always sound the same irrespective of which machine you play it on.